This webcast is a service of South Dakota Public Broadcasting. More information at sd.net.
We'll go ahead and get started with the Local Government Committee. And welcome to all of you that are here this morning. This morning's meeting will be general information for this committee, and also any of you that have something to give to us for information to consider the rest of the time for our decisions that have to do with local government. We'll get right into that. But first, we will have the roll call.
Representative Barthel.
Here.
Schwab.
Excused. Yeah.
Representative Drury.
Here.
Greenfield.
I had not heard from her.
Okay. Excused. Hoffman.
Here.
Johnson. Excused. Representative Mortensen.
Yep.
Representative Olson.
She's excused.
Reed.
Here.
Thomason.
Present.
Weisgram.
Here.
Jameson.
Here.
York.
Here.
Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you very much. Paige, we have a Paige here this morning that's going to help us out with anything that you may need. Would you come up and introduce yourself to us, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Griffin Peterson. I am a senior at Sully Buttes in Oneida this year, and my future plans are to attend USD next fall to major in to major in political science and criminal justice.
Perfect. You're in the right place. Okay. Is there any comments from the committee, first of all, before we get started? Otherwise, we'll go ahead, and our one speaker that I know of this morning is Ms. Yvonne Taylor, and she'll come up and introduce herself to all of you. By the way, we do have virtual testimony. If anybody is out there in remote land and would like to talk to us, all you have to do is call us. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Yvonne Taylor with the South Dakota Municipal League. And I look at this committee and I realize one of the reasons I love it is because almost all of you have been in local government in one way or the other. And that's what makes you, I think, an excellent committee. If I may, Madam Chairman, I have a handout. Oops, we don't have pages.
Absolutely.
Sorry. Two handouts. And as we're going through the information about municipal government today, I'm going to be saying we a lot. And so this is some data that has to do with the new census numbers. And it kind of shows that our municipalities in South Dakota are not some Mickey Mouse operation. We, in fact, are 72% of the state population lives within the boundaries of an incorporated municipality. We have 18 cities that are over 5,000 in population. T is our newest first-class city. It just moved up. Those 18 cities have 52% or 54%, I can't remember, it's on your sheet though, of the state's population live in just those 18 towns. And so when I say we, I'm talking about the people that represent a substantial portion of the citizens of South Dakota. South Dakota municipal government, I was asked to discuss like responsibilities and functions. It is much more about functions. We have absolutely really nothing that we absolutely have to provide. And so everything that a city does was at one time or another decided by the citizens in that community that it was something they wanted to have. Once they decide to do something, however, there are a tremendous number of laws that determine how we can provide those services. Municipalities are purely defined by Abraham Lincoln said, by what Abraham Lincoln said is the legitimate function of government. To do for a community of people what they need to have done that cannot do it all or do so well for themselves in their separate and individual capacities. And that's how municipal services come about. People want them and decide it would all be better to chip in with taxes and fees and provide those services collectively. We offer a full range of what would typically be considered municipal services. Law enforcement, either through individual city departments, sometimes in our smaller towns, one guy or one person, or through contracts with the county. We have a lot of several county law enforcement agencies. Law enforcement is general tax dollars. Obviously, it's not something that brings in revenue, and so that's something that's just paid for by the general fund. Fire protection, either through local volunteer fire departments, and those can have a wide variety of contact with the cities. Cities can be the ones that are in charge of those. They can have some relationship with that volunteer fire department or none. And then our largest cities have full-time professional paid fire departments. Streets. Almost every city has some kind of street department. In smaller towns, it's often combined in one general purpose guy who just has the oversight of pretty much everything in town. And they range from gravel to concrete to things with curb and gutter and things that don't. Streets are mostly supported by general tax revenue, maybe some special assessments and a little bit of license plate fee money. Water and sewer are a giant item in all of our cities, and you're going to be seeing a lot of talk about that this year. We are delighted to see $600 million going into the SRF funds for the water and sewer programs in South Dakota. They are water and sewer is fees normally based on the volume of usage, and so they are somewhat covered by that volume fee, but they are also subsidized by general tax dollars. To receive any SRF loans from the state, the city has to have a certain level of fee in place to make sure that they've got their own house in order, basically, before that the state will chip in with their federal funding and help with the systems. Probably one of the largest unrecognized issues that we have faced as a state is our infrastructure, and that is really coming to light this year, especially on the housing front, that infrastructure is a major problem to getting things done. In many of our towns, there are still the original pipes in the ground. We've heard of pipes that were made of brick, wood, in some places, and so as this money goes out, hopefully we're going to really be upgrading our systems. One of the things that a small town will find, if they hook up to a rural water system and they have to start paying for the volume of water that comes through, they will have sometimes 50-60% line loss because there are holes in their pipes that just didn't show up until they had to pay for the water in that way. And so that is hopefully a problem we're going to start seeing get solved. An unmeasured but huge cost is environmental enforcement in these areas. The Clean Drinking Water Act and the various EPA regulations that regulate sewer systems place a tremendous and very expensive burden on municipalities. The largest towns are under small stormwater phase two. That's the most recent federal thing that came in relationship to that. And then many years ago, a change that hit everyone was having a certified water operator. None of these are bad things, but they do cost money. And then for a smaller town, those certification requirements make it kind of hard to keep someone in that position. Once they get certified, they find out that there's greener grass somewhere else. A similar problem with law enforcement officers. Another area that became very expensive because of federal regulation is solid waste disposal. Years ago, everybody had the town dump, and you could just take everything out there. Those all got closed, and now we have, I think, 9 regional landfills. Again, a good thing, but very expensive, and they have to meet very strict environmental specifications when they're putting those landfills in place. Cities collect and haul garbage in various ways, either through their own services, they can contract or franchise for it, or they can do some combination of both. Parks and recreation, there is a full range of programs under this, from just having a green space with a picnic table in it to having full-blown recreational programs for kids in the summer, pools that are very extensive and expensive. And this is one of the most underestimated good things that a city can do. It creates a quality of life and provides a healthy, productive activities for our kids. And it's the kind of thing people look for when they come into town and look to move there or look to start a business there or get employees. They drive around and look and see how attractive the town is. And good parks are a big part of that quality of life and that attractiveness. We have 35 municipalities that own and operate their own electric utility companies, and a tremendous advantage for those towns. They're able to provide stable and typically lower rates than any other type of utility provider, and they control a lot of those other aspects too, the aesthetics of putting the lines underground instead of having lines running everywhere, where to put the transformers and the substations. We have three cities that own and operate their own phone systems, and we have one city that has its own cable system. Several cities have their gas distribution systems, and I think Watertown is the largest of those. Many cities have municipal airports with traffic that ranges from the local spray planes and the occasional small planes coming in for hunting season, for example, all the way up to our large regional airports, and they're incredibly valuable to the state to get people coming here. Libraries are usually owned and operated by the municipality. They are often done in coordination with some degree with a school district. Municipal auditoriums, community centers, and convention halls. We have municipal cemeteries. There are bus and transit systems, some that are owned and operated by a city and in the larger cities. More and more, we are finding the tremendous benefits that come with our rural transit system. And many of our elderly and other folks depend on that transit system for their transportation. We have some cities that operate hospitals and nursing homes, and we have some that participate in some degree to having their own daycare because it was the only way to have a daycare in town. We have all of the support services that any other business type activity would have. Every municipality has to have a finance officer, and that is about the one consistent position that is with every town. They do the bookkeeping, the billing, the collection. They conduct the elections, arrange for and take minutes and participate in the council meetings, prepare for the council meetings, and do a range of other things. Depending on the city, especially in our smaller towns, you'll find that finance officer wearing a lot of hats. They will have some part in being a personnel director. They will have some part in being the code enforcement officer in the code inspection services, planning and zoning. The finance officer just ends up being the jack of all trades in a smaller town that doesn't have the wherewithal to hire people to do all of those different things. And even in the largest cities, some of them combine the finance officer with the personnel director or will combine with city clerk type of activities will be combined. As far as cooperative efforts with other levels of local government, we are always looking for ways to do better at this and to do more. We do have places where cities work together. For example, they will coordinate with the surrounding county and do planning and zoning together. We have towns that share finance officers between them. Programs that do a building inspection and a code enforcement officer that works for multiple towns and makes that an affordable thing for cities to be able to do. Some things can't work. You can only economically run a water or a sewer line so far. Some of the people who maintain those systems could probably be shared. Terrain matters. There's an old line about all of the stuff that runs downhill. It does not always run downhill, so we have to build lift stations to get it up the hill. So terrain does matter, and if you have those hilly areas, things are just not as practical as they might be, as where I grew up in the flatlands. With the counties, law enforcement is one area that is often coordinated. And there could probably be, and there is some coordination between highway and street departments. Regional jails are often coordinated, and 911 service systems are mostly coordinated. What limits cities from consolidating either services or actual boundaries is obviously the distance between them. And what limits cities from doing more with surrounding areas, like the counties, and the provision of services is that some of these services that we've covered are unique to cities. And so you can't do in joint powers something that you can't both do. And so cities provide services that counties do not. And so it's just not something that we can work together with the counties on. As to how cities operate in South Dakota, we have three major forms of government. They are the aldermanic. We have 128 of those towns. In the aldermanic form, you have two people elected from each ward of the city. Rapid City would be our largest aldermanic city, aldermanic form. Two are elected, and then there is a mayor who is elected at large. This is the only form of government in which the mayor has the authority to veto proposals. And so the mayor does not vote on anything, but they do have the power to veto. They have the power to break a tie on everything that doesn't spend money. And so the position of mayor is a little unique in the aldermanic form. The trustee form is what most of our smaller towns use. There are 159 trustees. trustee cities. This is where 3 to 5 people are elected at large in their town, and then each year they annually select one of their own members to serve as the town board president, so effectively the mayor. And then we have the commission form. This is probably primarily larger towns use this, but there are only 12 of the commission form in South Dakota. That again is 3 to 5 commissioners, all elected at large, and they have special areas that they oversee within their city that are spelled out in statute. Any of these can hold, any of those three forms can hold an election to hire a city manager, which is a different form of government, a professional manager who has some statutory powers and protections. Cities can, without an election, hire a city administrator, and that person is someone who can do a lot of the same things that a city manager can do, but does not have that statutory authority or protection. We have, between the two of them, we're seeing more and more of these come slowly. I would guess we have 30 of them right now, but full-blown city managers, maybe 10, maybe 11. And any one of these, any city, can throw everything out the window and adopt a home rule charter, which allows them to just create the form of government that works best for them. And we have 10 cities that have opted to do that. The last thing I wanted to hit quickly is tax revenue. And I think my numbers might be getting stale. I need to update them. But roughly, the cities of South Dakota use about 12% of the property tax dollar. Our levies amount to about that. But most of our tax revenue is from the sales tax. We are heavily dependent on that local sales tax to do everything out of the general fund that we do. And that is about 70% of our tax revenue will come from our sales tax. And with that, Madam Chairman, that's my short rundown, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Most of you, having been local officers of some kind, have probably met Yvonne, but little known fact about Yvonne is that she now holds the job that Senator John Thune once held. So there could be some potential there, do you think? Any questions for Ms. Taylor? I would remind you that just like any other meeting, the questions will flow through the chairman.
Of course, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Taylor, you just mentioned the Home Rule Charter and about 10 folks have adopted. Would you give us 2 or 3 minutes of your best high-level explanation for the upshot of the Home Rule Charter adoption?
Yes, Madam Chair. The municipalities in South Dakota are what we call Dillon's Rule. We are a Dillon's Rule state. That means municipalities are creatures of the state. We can only do the things that are allowed by the legislature or such things as are necessarily implied by what is specifically allowed by the legislature. Home Rule picks that up and turns it on its head and says you can do anything they say, they don't say you can't. That was double negatives, and I don't know how that worked out. But, a home rule city can do anything that is not prohibited by the state. We are very big fans of home rule at the Municipal League.
Other questions? Anyone else? Well, I thank you for taking your time to come over. Did someone else have a question? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned, you said that you can't do in joint powers what you both can't do. Would you give me an example of something that you would not be authorized to partner up with a county to do?
It's probably, it's probably easier to say something we can. I mean, if you take counties have the power to plan and zone and cities have the power to plan and zone, so we can do that together. I believe all of the regional landfills are probably some sort of a joint powers arrangement between local government agencies that have joined together, provided those, some of them anyway, are provided that way. I'm trying to think, we would like to see the counties have the ability to do business improvement districts. Right now they cannot. It might be nice if we could work together and do some business improvement district kind of things together with the county. So that would be one example, I guess.
Okay, so just to be clear, if one can do a thing, if a municipality can but the county cannot, that's what you mean you could not enter into a joint powers agreement on?
Madam Chair, correct.
Okay.
if there aren't any further questions for Ms. Taylor, is anybody else here that would like to come up and introduce themselves to this committee? Because you'd like the committee to be familiar with you for some bill that you may have coming up during session. Anyone at all? Any questions or comments from the committee? Okay, I'm going to ask the committee, we can formally adjourn our regular meeting, and I just want to have some conversation with the committee, and it certainly could be open. Which would you prefer? Do we adjourn or stay open?
Your call.
Okay, I think we'll go ahead and stay in open session, because the one main thing that I wanted to tell you that came up when we had our chairman's meeting is, as you know, when we have a bill, we have testimony, and con. So now we can have a third category called the neutral testimony. A neutral testimony is at the discretion of the chairman, so that's why I'm leaving it up to this committee if you want to have such a thing on our agenda or not. And neutral testimony would be informational, probably. They cannot slant their testimony to be either for or against a bill. That would be the danger, that somebody might try and slip that in, which at that time we would have to call them on that and say, I'm sorry, proponents have already been heard. You'll have to sit. So I don't know. What does the committee prefer? Could I have some conversation on that? You're going to be talking about this in all your committees because we've all been given that option. Go ahead, Representative Reed.
I think that's a good idea. Sometimes there are organizations that either through their charter or even sometimes it's federal law, can't testify as a proponent or an opponent. And so it would give them the opportunity to share information. One, and sometimes I guess like an organization, this organization doesn't necessarily can't be proponent or an opponent, but it's the Center for the Prevention of Child Maltreatment. At times they just want to give information on the subject.
Right.
And so I believe it'd be a good idea.
Yeah, that's exactly what the category would be about. Any other comments about that?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Mortensen.
So, Madam Chair, I'd just echo that. The State Bar Association is another entity that is prohibited under a couple of constitutional rulings, since we're a mandatory bar. That is, if I'm going to be an attorney, I have to pay in to be, that they can't take a lot of positions. So to the degree that it will free up organizations and people with information to give us more information on the record, I think that's probably better for our process. If the options are come up as neutral or just stay seated, frankly, I'd always rather have the on the record perspective.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hoffman.
Madam Chair, I agree with the previous two speakers. There's only one time I think that we could run into a problem, and that is if our bill docket is really full by allowing a third type and point of testimony, we may run into a time constraint problem. And if you have the opportunity that day to say we, because of time, will not allow any neutral testimony, I think that would be a speedy way for us to get through our committee. That's my only concern. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for that. Any other comments? The other option that we had was, or the other choice, would we have the neutral testimony first before we have proponents or opponents? Would the committee have my preference would be to have them first, the neutral first. And then we'll hear both sides of the story.
Madam Chair, as a clarification, do you mean before the bill's sponsor comes and pitches the bill?
The bill sponsor would do his presentation like always, and then I usually call for proponents and opponents. With this new method, I could call for the neutral testimony to start it out. We have to put it in someplace, either at the beginning or at the end.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Hoffman.
And I think a point of clarification would be that once we've gone through proponent and opponent testimony, you lost your chance to speak to our committee neutrally. Because somebody may all of a sudden, oh, I've got new information, and that could drag on forever. But I think it's a opening up, it's a sunshine for people who, as Representative Mortensen said, may not have been able to testify. I mean, the balance in the judicial system is one that we have to weigh heavily. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a good discussion, and I think it's interesting all the different perspectives that have been aired already. But with regard to having the neutral testimony first, and with regard to the good representative from up north, comments about the time constraints, if you were to allow, let's say, equal time for the neutral, and then you put it at the front, you've lost your opportunity at discretion to control the length of that hearing by not having the neutral testimony. You know what I'm saying? So I think putting it at the end would probably be better, time permitting, and again, at your own discretion. And I'm fine with you using your discretion to apply the neutral testimony. But I think if you put it at the end, then you have the option, if we're running short on time, to avoid that. But if you put it at the front, you still have to do the pro and the con.
Right. Okay. Any other discussion on that? Yes. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we do allow neutral testimony, will we also be allowed to vote? Maybe.
And how many times would we love to do that, right? I don't think that was part of the deal. No. Okay. Well, if you have any other comments, feel free to send me an email or come over and visit with me about it, and I'll take all your comments into consideration. And I do, you know, in a way, I like the idea of having it at our discretion whether we have neutral testimony or not. But then on the other side of it, I think, you know, the person that's up here making the bill presentation would think, well, why can't I have neutral testimony when so-and-so did? So I think we have to do it one way or another. I don't think we can bounce around, even if we had just a short, brief time for information only. So we'll get those decisions made. I appreciate your input. Anything else for the good of the committee? Yes. Representative Drury.
Madam Chair, personal privilege?
Yes.
I would just like to give a shout out to one of my former council people, he's still a council person in Rapid City, and his name is Richie Nordstrom. He serves in Ward 2. He recently was selected to join the National League of Cities Transportation and Infrastructure Services Federal Advocacy Committee. Most of us are probably familiar with the National League, and I think this is just a great thing for South Dakota and especially for Rapid City, and I'm extremely proud of Alderman Nordstrom. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling that to our attention. Sounds like it could be a commemorative, too. Okay, anything else for the good of the committee? Okay, otherwise I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved. Second.
Motion made and seconded. Madam Secretary, would you call the roll, please?
Voice
vote. I've been informed by LRC that this year we have to do a voice vote on, or a roll call vote on everything, including adjournment.
If there's a remote, and since Olson isn't remote.
Oh. Okay, now they're informing me that it's only if we have remote testimony going on.
Yes. Remote members.
Members. Remote members out there. Okay. Well, then we can just do a voice vote.
Yes, but before we do that, could I get Hoffman moved to adjourn and Johnson seconded? Yes. Thank you.
Okay. Motion made and seconded to adjourn. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. You are adjourned. I'll see you on Thursday morning. Okay.